All the times I'd shout out for my mother to come help me in the middle of the night when I couldn't move or something had gone terribly wrong. It would only take her a minute to get to me, and I would know that I was safe. I was feeling so much fear about leaving her. I wanted and needed to move out and start my life, but I also had to address my fears first. Fear number one, help, I've fallen and I can't get up. There are plenty of preventative measures you can take to make sure you don't end up laying on your floor for 3 days, including living with a roommate. Whether it's a friend or a significant other, not living completely alone can be an unimaginably huge source of comfort. Even if they're not your main caretaker, just having another body in the house means they'll be able to help you out of tricky situations. Using a life alert system. Hey, it worked for the lady in the commercial. But seriously, life alert and systems like it can be valuable to those who are sick and unsteady on their feet. There are systems that can connect you to an operator who can give you the choice of calling an ambulance or a family member. Keeping your cell on you at all times. While I don't always have mine in my back pocket, I do make sure to always bring my phone with me whenever I go, just in case of emergency. I don't want to have to climb up the stairs if I'm having a physical emergency. Fear number two. Can I stay healthy enough to keep my job? This was the number one question I received through my blog last year, and it is understandably a common fear. Here are some suggestions on how you can plan to help keep your job. Begin saving. While it won't always be realistic to save 90% of your paycheck, start putting away as much as you can bear to live without. Even if you're just throwing $20 here and there into your online savings account, it starts to add up. Have a financial support system and be responsible about it. When it came to taking money from friends and family, I felt ashamed. But the idea of living at home with my parents until I was 40 was just as shameful. When push came to shove, if I needed to borrow money, I did. As soon as I could, I paid back what I owed. Have a credit card and good credit. It's not like you can snap your fingers and instantly have all those medical debts removed from your credit report. You can't go back in time and erase the month you were late on rent because you were in the hospital and unable to get out of bed. But working on creating good credit or mending bad credit should be a priority for you. At the end of the day, you may just not have the funds to support the extra financial burden that comes with having a chronic disease. Check your company's rules and your employee rights. Not sure if your sick days will cover the amount of days in which you may be sick? Speak with your company's HR person and try to create some preventative measures to help you stay employed. You may be able to work from home on certain days, or you may be able to take an extended leave. What you won't want to do is start considering these resources after you've already used up your sick days and your employer's patience and goodwill. Fear number three. What if I have nothing in the house to eat and I'm too fatigued to make it to the grocery store and back? You stock up. Frozen meals, canned meals, etc. I even keep a couple of individual bags of Chex Mix in my upstairs bathroom cabinets, just in case I can't make it downstairs and I need to eat something filling with my medication. If I've run out of my stockpile, I can always get a delivery from a local restaurant or call in a favor from a friend who can pick me up something. You can't always rely on greasy takeout, though, so you may consider making and freezing some healthier meals to keep on hand. Fear number four. I'm scared I won't be able to handle the stress on my own. Are you really on your own? If you can still reach out to family, friends, coworkers, or a therapist, you're only a phone call away from a pep talk and a reminder that you can do this. At this point, You've learned how to create a psychological, spiritual, medical, and social support system. If you're still not sure if your network is strong enough, consider revisiting the information in chapters 4, 5, and 6. I'll admit that most of these fears are about situations that are small in the grand scheme of your life with a chronic illness. I certainly have had times that I had to push all this preparedness aside due to a real emergency that no amount of planning would have prevented. What happens if you need to handle serious emergencies on your own? Managing medical emergencies independently. I've ended up in the emergency room alone, and I won't lie to you and say it isn't a scary place to be. When you're in a crisis and you're the only one that can speak on your behalf, the importance of independence loses its appeal. One way I help myself through this is by making sure I've got the important stuff written down. If you do a little planning like this, something as scary and unfamiliar as a lonely ER room is easier to navigate on your own. I carry a list of current medications, allergies, and a list of past surgeries on a set of laminated note cards in my purse, just in case I can't speak for myself. That information will be very clear. Download, photocopy, and fill out the handy online medication list card and emergency list card at newharbinger.com/35999. I also have my emergency contacts listed in my phone under favorites. This makes it easier for you to find your emergency phone numbers if you're under the haze of medication. You may also want to keep a list of a few different cab companies if you don't have a ride-sharing service in your town. Here are a few more things to prepare so that your worst fear doesn't become your worst nightmare. Setting yourself up for success. Prep number one. Location, location, location. You know when it's a great time to live an hour and a half away from your medical team? Never. Save yourself the agony of schlepping down the highway during your worst symptoms. Even if you see your main specialists out of town, set up a local crew of doctors who are going to be able to help you manage the day-to-day care. Same rules apply for your pharmacy, grocery store, at least one or two pizza delivery places, and a gas station. In the face of being stranded from the resources you'll need, making these connections locally or moving to a better location may ultimately be more of a help than a hassle. Prep number two, have your doctor's information on hand. If you're under the care of a regular specialist or general physician, they may be able to guide your ER doctors through your medical history on the phone. If your doctor has a large practice, it may still be difficult to get medical advice when they don't have their file in front of you. Because of this, many patients seek out the help of concierge doctors who often take on smaller patient loads and can more readily recall details from different cases. Generally, contracts with concierge doctors state that they will help guide your care in emergency situations and hospitalizations. Prep number three. If possible, bring a body. Even if your mom, husband, best friend, brother, or nana can't make it to the ER with you, try as hard as you possibly can to get a friend of any caliber to at least help you get checked in. Sometimes just having a familiar face in the room to hurry up the doctor when you're bleeding out of your eyeballs can be useful. Prep number four. Remember your nurse's name and ask for a call button. This is a critical detail. Remembering your nurse's name ensures liability. While you're in the ER, the nurse should know you're not only going to remember her name and the fact that she likes cartoons on her scrubs, but also that if she doesn't wash her hands before handling your port, she is going to get reported to her supervisor. Asking for a call button is also key. Once you're down, there's a good possibility that between the IV and heart monitors, you may not be able to get back up. Being able to buzz the nurses for assistance can save you a lot of stress and possibly wet sheets. What's the worst that could happen? Fear is just the accumulation of unknowns. An exercise my mother used to do with me was to ask, "What's the worst that could happen?" And then I would answer, "I'd be sick in the middle of the night and wouldn't be able to get a ride to the hospital." She would ask, "And then what?" "Well," I'd say, feeling angry that wasn't enough, "that I'd have no ride to the hospital." "And then what?" "Then I'd probably have to call 911 and get an ambulance, or maybe just a cab." "And then what?" "And then I'd get there eventually, I guess, but it would suck." It's annoying when someone makes you see reason when you've been clinging to fear to stop yourself from taking risks. This exercise helped me to realize that while the outcomes of my fears weren't always pleasant, they more often than not did not result in my intense suffering. Chances are, your fears have already transpired in one form or another. Challenge your anxiety the next time it creeps up on you. What would happen? And what would you do? Have a plan and worry less. The key to independence: accept the unexpected. My life is filled with unknowns. I have very little control over what's going on in my body. I can't stop a migraine if it's coming. I can't control how quickly I'll dehydrate or how a new food will affect my stomach. I've accidentally dropped my last pill down the drain more times than I want to admit. A good rule to remember when it comes to outsmarting chronic illness is that you can't prevent situations from happening 100% of the time. But the preparations and tips provided in this chapter will save you lots of hassle. Ultimately, you can't prepare for a situation you don't see coming. There will be many instances where you'll have to just cock your head to the side and say, "Huh, I didn't know that cannoli was going to make an attempt on my life," before ducking into the nearest convenience store bathroom with the most profound regret. At some point, you will look at your choices and think, "I knew better. I may have wanted a different outcome, but I knew better." You need to start balancing your risks and benefits. For example, if I decide to go shopping this afternoon, will I have enough energy to go to the movies tonight? I really want dessert, but my stomach is already a 7 on the flare scale. Will a slice of cake throw me over the edge? Independence will mean being accountable for any and every way you decide to tip the scales. There will come a point where you can't push yourself. You can't make everyone happy. You can't pay all the bills. And you can't be there for every person in your life. The question to ask yourself is, who and what gets priority? What is your priority? Moving out was a huge boost to my self-esteem, and it will be the same for you. Knowing that I could survive on my own was extremely gratifying. It gave me hope about the direction of my life. It was high up on my list of priorities. For me to remain independent, I had to be able to afford it, which meant that I had to be able to work. For me to be able to handle all my clients, I had to be constantly on top of my health. Hospitalizations meant unpaid leave. I couldn't avoid all of them, but I needed to do everything in my power to make them as short and as infrequent as possible. Having a solid treatment plan and a doctor who was available to help me make medication choices was a must. I also realized that I needed to act preventatively. That meant making sure I was at my doctor at the same time every week to get IVs. It also meant starting an exercise regimen through a cardiac rehab program at the hospital to keep up my strength. I also had to stay on top of my medication refills. Frankly, being sick gave me near heroic powers of organization. It completely transformed the way I looked at different parts of my life. For example, How important was it really that I made a homemade souffle every holiday when it almost always cost me as much energy as I would need to attend the dinner? If scrubbing my apartment floor was going to knock me out of commission for 2 days, wasn't it financially more responsible to hire a housekeeper? I did a serious intake of what really mattered to me. For me, it is spending time with my family and friends and my dog. It is about focusing on my career so I can have a good quality of life. I didn't need to keep up with everyone I went to high school with and aggressively stalked online. I didn't need to cook dinner for my fiancé every night. I didn't need to put on the song and dance for my in-laws, my judgmental relatives, or even my nosy professors or coworkers. All I needed to do was take care of my needs and make sure my bills were paid and my health was stable. What do you feel is your most important priority in service of your independence? Is it focusing fully on your career or school and pushing your schedule to the limit? Is it stabilizing your treatment by experimenting with newer drugs and therapies that might have unknown side effects? Is it training a new puppy or nurturing a new relationship? Whatever your priority, hopefully the tools in this chapter will help you to plan and create safeguards for a more autonomous life with chronic illness. Chapter 9. Becoming your own patient advocate. It is your body and your responsibility to treat it with confidence, intelligence, and above all, compassion. You need to own every nerve ending, every cell, and every action you take using this body of yours. You should never let anyone take away your right to make the choices you believe are best for it. Being your own patient advocate means fighting for your opinions about your treatment to be heard. Have you been using your voice? Have you been heard? Often, when the prescription pad is pulled out of the doctor's pocket, most patients don't interject. Why would you? You're not the doctor here. Maybe you agree that medication will work best for you if your doctor says so. Maybe you have no idea what kind of fungus is growing on your foot, and you trust your doctor to give you the right ointment. However, you must know that there is a significant difference between being blindly led into the wilds of unknown treatment and being consciously guided by someone you feel is qualified to have an opportunity to earn your trust. Smart patients understand that their treatment is a collaborative effort. It takes both the educated patient and the educated physician to find, test, and maintain good health. Being an advocate for yourself doesn't mean recklessly shooting down every medical opinion you don't agree with, and it certainly doesn't mean changing your course of treatment without a consult with your doctor. Being your own advocate means recognizing the weight of your choices, doing the background research on doctors and choosing the best medical ally, maximizing the amount of time you have with your doctor by being clear, composed, and knowledgeable about your medical history, knowing when to change your medical care team, being a proactive patient, fighting for your quality of life. It's no question that being your own advocate is a lot of work. Suddenly, you've gone from being a bystander to an active participant in your care. You're now doing the research, asking the major questions, and finding the confidence to speak up. If you want the most out of life with chronic illness, you're going to have to fight for it. The choices you'll make. From my first fight with my pediatrician over antibiotics to my insistence that fiber would be a poor addition to my diet with gastroparesis, I've had many all-out fights with gastroenterologists and nutritionists who have recommended different diets without taking a strong look at my disease and its symptoms. It's been up to me to educate my physicians, and if they refuse to be educated, I've often had to refuse their care. There are only so many times you can eat a kale salad before you fully succumb to the idea that your stomach finds it indigestible. It can be a world of protest for patients with chronic, invisible, progressive, and lifelong diseases, whose long-term treatment can mean switching on and off medications and trying new or off-label scripts. Doctors, nurses, and insurance companies can sometimes be barriers against your medical opportunities. Take their advice with a grain of salt, because even though they really do want what's best for you, they don't always know what that is. You can't be afraid to speak up, argue, or worry that you're being cumbersome with your line of questioning. Somebody's got to make the judgment call, and when it's your quality of life on the line, you'll find that you will be that annoying, overly analytical patient. When you hit the wall of your doctor's tolerance, you may feel like you've overstepped. When you feel guilty about it, dig deep and tell yourself to get over it. This isn't an oil change on your car. This is the only body you're going to have your whole life. Its well-being comes before good manners. You have spent your whole life coming to terms with what you can't change. These medical interventions are a key place for you to exercise your free will and shape your life. The older I get, the more I know with real certainty that no one knows best, not your mom, doctor, best friend, or that guy online. Nobody has the table of contents. This is a choose-your-own-adventure kind of story. You make the final decision on what medications you take, what surgeries you go through, whose hands you put yourself in, and most importantly, whose voice you choose to speak for you when you cannot speak for yourself. Finding a medical ally. While it may not seem like a huge hurdle for others, managing your health care when you have an active disease is a large responsibility. Selecting your own doctors, researching your own medications and surgeries, handling your health insurance, and monitoring your stress and mental health is a full-time job. Even though you may be able to delegate some medical responsibilities to the doctors you feel are competent, you must always take the lead. This doesn't mean arguing against every suggested medical opinion. It just means making sure that the professionals around you are on the same page as you. How can you ensure that you and your medical team are on the same page? Discuss your thoughts and opinions before the appointment and do your research. Being a prepared patient helps your team to focus in on the best solutions. My goals vary from specialist to specialist. When it comes to my ENT doctor, I want to make sure he gets the right cultures for any infection I might have. I've discussed my immune deficiency disease with him, and it's important to me that I only ever go on antibiotics when they're 100% necessary, and when we've tested a culture to see what it is resistant to. Because of this communication, I can avoid multiple prescriptions for the wrong problem. By sticking to my guns and making sure my wishes are followed through on, I've managed to make a positive impact on my care. Finding a new doctor when you're undiagnosed. When you're still searching for a diagnosis, it's important to find a doctor who has the time and capabilities to do the necessary testing and research you'll need. How can you know who has the time when you're flipping through your insurance booklet? Or worse, how do you find a good match when you have no insurance and have limited options of where you can be treated? First thing you'll need is to consult with a primary care physician, PCP, also known as a general internist, so they can categorize your symptoms and push you toward the right specialist. You can find one either through a list you can request from your insurance company, or simply by searching online for an internist in your area. Word of mouth and online reviews and ratings can be helpful, but you'll probably get the soundest advice about the doctor through their office manager. When making an appointment, ask their office the following. I'm an undiagnosed patient with a large cluster of symptoms. I may need to sit with the doctor longer than 10 minutes to explain everything. Do you think he has the time to consider this? And if so, What would be the best time of the day to schedule my appointment with him? You may also want to ask what his patient load is. You'll want to find a doctor with a small patient load if possible. This means they don't have to double book as often, and you'll spend less time in the waiting room and more time with the treating physician. Before you see a general internist, you'll want to call and speak directly to someone at your insurance company. You'll need to ask whether you'll need a referral to see a specialist. You'll also want to ask what the copay is to see a specialist, and if testing that is done in office is covered by your copay. If you don't have coverage, it's time to consider low-income insurance options in your area. Finding a new doctor after a diagnosis. If you've already been diagnosed and you're looking for a specialist, you'll be able to narrow down the right physician for you a lot more easily. You'll want to ask the same questions to make sure this doctor has the time and patient load to realistically take on a complicated chronic illness patient. Once you're at your appointment with the doctor, here are a few questions you can ask. Do you regularly treat patients with my disease? What sort of treatments are the patients you are treating with my disease receiving? Are you current on all the new research? You may want to bring in any papers on new medications you've researched and may want to try. Do you have same-day, next-day appointments if I have an emergency? Are you affiliated with my local hospital? And will you be able to direct my treatment in the emergency room and during a hospital stay? If you don't have insurance and your specialist has decided that you need treatment, you still have some options on how to obtain that care. Hospitals will generally work with patients who need treatments by putting an affordable payment plan in place. Drug companies have also been known to sponsor treatment for patients or provide medications for free or at a discounted price. Considering a concierge doctor. You may be wondering what a concierge doctor is. Maybe you've seen them in movies and TV shows. They also exist in the everyday world to treat patients like you and me. These doctors take on a smaller patient load, generally under 300 patients, compared to most general internist practices, which have well over 1,000 patients. For an annual or quarterly fee, around $1,800 to $2,000 per year, you'll have a doctor at your beck and call. Perks to having a concierge doctor on retainer are having their personal cell phone number to reach them at all times, having a doctor who is familiar with your case even without his file in front of you, having a lead physician to guide your care in the emergency room. These perks can be a huge relief for patients with pain management problems who are constantly scrutinized, patients with complicated medical histories, or patients with rare diseases who have no experts in their area and need someone committed to researching new and innovative treatments. Contrary to popular belief, care by these doctors isn't only for the wealthy. The average cost of a concierge physician is around just $150 per month. That's less than an average car payment or even the cost of a pastry and a coffee each day. Many concierge patients have found that reliable care by a doctor who knows them well resulted in lower healthcare costs. As a result, there were fewer emergency room visits and long hospitalizations, less unnecessary or repetitive testing, and more preventative care. Doctor recommendations, referrals, and bad reviews. I've got an ENT that I'd talk your ear off about. He's the best ENT doctor in Boca Raton. I'm sure my sinuses would be forever sealed without his intervention. Recommendations from friends and fellow patients are always great tools in finding the best doctor for you. You'll also want to remain open-eared when it comes to bad recommendations. I had to go through 3 bad ENTs to get to the good one. Lastly, if you have no friends or fellow patients who will reveal their favorite doctors, look to your general doctor to get a referral. This only applies to referrals for specialists. Don't ask your doctor for a doctor who can replace them. They don't like that. Check out the following websites to get you started. RateMDs.com. This site offers information and ratings for millions of doctors and health specialists around the world. ZocDoc.com. This site helps you find a doctor and book appointments instantly. You can also read reviews of each doctor by different patients. HealthGrades.com. This site provides information on doctors, specialists, and hospitals close to you. Referrals. When asking your doctor for a referral to a specialist, you must be very specific about what you're looking for. Doctors may work frequently with just one doctor, so they may suggest just that one doctor that they know. If they can't suggest more than just that one doctor, that's how you know they're picking from a limited pool. Ask questions like, why do you recommend him? You want to know if they're recommending them because they're a good doctor or a good friend. Make sure to also ask if the doctor has performed this procedure on a lot of their patients. A doctor can always recommend another doctor for treatment, but make sure he's doing it specifically for the needs of your treatment. Lastly, ask which hospitals the doctor is affiliated with. This is a good question to ask to make sure that if you need to be hospitalized, the doctor will be able to visit you there to direct your care. Bad reviews. What if you've heard bad things about a doctor, but you're unsure if they're true or not? While most people would steer clear either way, you may have a limited number of physicians to choose from through your insurance company. Start by doing your own investigative process. Search online for more reviews about the doctor. Call the doctor's front office and ask salient questions about their care. Review their education and experience level. If you're feeling brave, go in for a consultation. Sometimes a short visit is worth the time spent to not miss out on what could be a good physician. Recommendations. Some people just like to brag about how well connected they are. Just because they know and have seen 1,000 doctors doesn't mean that all of them had a great bedside manner and cured cancer during their 15-minute consult. When someone gives a good review, make sure to ask specific questions like, was the doctor familiar with your disease, or did you have to explain it to them? Did they go over your entire medical history or just want the highlights? Did they read up on any new treatments, or were they recommending a lot of things you'd already tried? Your recommendations. Don't forget that it's your duty as a patient to keep that flow of information going. If you find a good doctor, shout it from the mountaintops. Don't you wish that someone had steered you clear of that wacko surgeon that botched your surgery? Or kept you from even entering the geneticist's office at that teaching hospital who made it his mission to humiliate his patients in front of his teaching students? Doctors may vow to do no harm, but it is the patients who keep the good ones in business long enough to keep that promise. Now you have the tools to find the right care for you. Let's put them to use. Ready to choose? Found a doctor who might be a good fit, but you're just not quite sure yet? You can do your research online or by checking with your referring doctor. Make sure you know and feel comfortable with the answers to the following questions before you decide. Is this doctor board certified? Are they licensed? Check with your state's medical licensing board if this isn't explicitly listed in their credentials. How long have they been practicing? Do they have any malpractice suits against them? Are they affiliated with your local hospital? Do they have malpractice insurance? If not, why? Do they take your insurance, or can you work out an affordable financing plan for treatment? If the doctor you're researching is a surgeon, consider the success rate of their past surgeries. How many have they performed? Comparing treatment. Most patients with chronic illness eventually develop a second or third condition. New diseases mean new symptoms, which means new treatments. Researching your new prescriptions can be helpful, and it's always smart to do your own research. Connecting with people who have had a similar surgery you're considering or are currently taking a new drug you're about to try can be a valuable source of information. When you pool a patient community's knowledge of treatments, you end up opening doors you or your doctor probably haven't even considered. How you evaluate a new prescription is similar to how you would refer, recommend, and rate a doctor. Ask around, look for reviews from other patients, and ask other patients to share their personal experiences. Did they react with certain symptoms? What has been the long-term outcome of taking this medication? Has it been a financial burden, or has the insurance company been gracious about getting the generic? Did it do its job? The crux of patient advocacy can really be summed up into just that. Did the doctor, hospital, or treatment do its job? Was I treated with respect during it? In the next section, advocate Lauren Stiles talks about incorporating these two points into your basic 15-minute doctor exam. Getting the most out of your 15 minutes. Stiles is the CEO and co-founder of Dysautonomia International, a patient organization that offers resources, organizes research, and hosts an annual conference for patients. Stiles has served in leadership positions on government councils, nonprofit boards, and professional associations. She developed dysautonomia, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, symptoms overnight at age 31. After a relentless 2-year quest to find an underlying cause for her symptoms, she was finally diagnosed with autonomic neuropathy, caused by an autoimmune disease, Sjogren's syndrome. Since co-founding Dysautonomia International in 2012, Stiles has been an outspoken advocate for individuals living with autonomic disorders. She has lectured on autonomic disorders at the National Institute of Health, Duke University, Harvard University, and Stony Brook University. Her work educating patients on how to receive the best care has hugely impacted the invisible disease community. If you are lucky enough to find a doctor who spends more than the usual 15 minutes with you, that's wonderful. But most of us are going to have to deal with those it's-over-before-you-blink visits from time to time, especially when seeing a new specialist. You may have waited 2 years and sold your family heirlooms to get an appointment with Dr. Big Expectations, but you aren't going to have all the time you want to tell him about your 101 weird symptoms, all the tests you've had, all the treatments that didn't work, and why you fired your last idiot doctor. Assume you have 15 minutes. You may be given more time, but it's important to have realistic expectations. This is the reality of the hamster treadmill that is modern medicine. Your doctor is probably not being brief with you because he's a jerk. He just has 40 other patients to see that day, several hours of ridiculous forms to fill out, 100 emails to read and respond to, and 70 phone calls to make before he goes home today. Doctors have the highest suicide rate of any profession because they are so stressed out. So don't take it personally when you don't get all the time you need. No one else is getting the time they need either, including your doctor. Before you even make the appointment, ask yourself, why do I want to see this doctor? This should be the goal of your visit. Does she have a special skill that may benefit you? Does he offer a test or treatment that you want to look into? Are you just looking for a second opinion? The following exercise is a great way for patients to get clarity on their needs before heading into an appointment. Make 4 lists before your appointment on separate pieces of paper. A. Questions you need answers to, from most pressing to least pressing. B. Your current symptoms, from most bothersome to least bothersome. C. Your prior diagnoses. And D. Your current meds and drug allergies. Put the date of the office visit and your name on each page. Give these to the doctor or the nursing staff when you arrive, and ask them to put a photocopy of each page in your chart. You'll want a copy on hand, too, when you speak with the doctor. When you meet the doctor, offer a handshake, a smile, and a nice to meet you. Doctors are human beings, and most of them prefer dealing with friendly patients. You want this doctor to want to help you. As chronic illness patients, we have probably seen our fair share of crappy doctors that leave us feeling frustrated and angry. Don't hold this against your new doctor. Assume he or she will be fabulous, until proven otherwise. Doctors usually begin the appointment by asking what's wrong. This is when you tell them the goal of your visit. Use phrases like, "I'm hoping you can," or "I would like your help in finding out." Don't give orders like, "I need you to," or "I want you to." Be deferential to the doctor, without being a pushover or a kiss-up. Be focused and rely on your written questions during the appointment. Don't say bad things about other doctors or hospitals, even if they were total jerks. Whatever you do, don't bring a giant binder of medical records into the exam room. If you are a chronic illness patient, you probably have a forest worth of trees and paperwork on your prior lab results, doctor's notes, imaging studies, etc. It's fine to bring this to your appointment, but you will scare off most doctors if this is the first impression they have of you. Leave the binder in the car or with a friend in the waiting room. If you need to bring it into the exam room, put it in a backpack so it doesn't become the elephant in the room as you try to have a focused conversation with your doctor. That binder can very easily be misinterpreted as hypochondriac, attention seeker, or patient that is too complicated to get involved with. If the doctor wants any of your prior medical records, you can find out what they want and give the relevant documents to their secretary after the appointment to make copies of, or you can offer to fax it to them after your visit. As you end your visit, make sure you understand the game plan moving forward. Is the doctor ordering tests or writing a prescription? Where do you go for the tests? Who will get the insurance approval for the tests? How will you get the results? When should you come back for a follow-up? Don't forget to end your visit with a "thanks for your time." Grandma's advice comes to mind. You get more bees with honey. When is it time to change your healthcare team? When my medication fails time after time, the emergency room visits become too close together, and my assigned diet is not working, I wonder, is it time to find a new doctor? Sometimes doctors can get complacent with our care. We'll have a short discussion about some new symptoms, but overall, there are no major changes suggested in terms of new medications or therapies. No new testing is done, and you begin to get the idea that your doctor is very plainly saying, "Well, this is as good as it's going to get, kid." If you find yourself in that situation and you feel you cannot convince your doctor to find new solutions to your care, take that as a clear sign to find another physician who might know of another option. Deciding when to make a change in your healthcare is a constant in self-advocacy. It's important to do a serious evaluation from time to time to see if your needs are really being met by your doctor. You should always be evaluating your quality of life and demanding the best out of it. Your doctor should be on your team, in your court, and with their head fully in the game. How do you know if your current doctor is the right one for you? Start by asking yourself these questions. Do I feel like my symptoms are under control? Are my questions being answered in a way I can understand? Am I getting back full reports on my blood tests and other diagnostics? Do I feel comfortable with the medications I'm on, or do I think we could do better? Does my doctor have enough time for me? Are my appointments being cut short or being rushed? Is my doctor available to me during emergencies? Is my treatment in the ER being managed by them? Are they or someone else in their office familiar with my condition, available by phone or email in case of emergencies? If you're answering no or not really to most of these questions, then it's probably time to start looking for a new doctor. For me and many other patients with complicated diseases, needing to find a new healthcare team after a few years is something that happens without fail. I've had three main quarterbacks for my medical team in the past 5 years. While I can say with confidence that each doctor was capable, qualified, and worked hard to help me manage my disease, they ultimately reached a point where they could no longer offer insight on what would be my next step. My disease is progressive. It was only natural that I had to move on from my team and transition to a new set of professionals who would be able to take on the next round of research with fresh eyes. It's okay to say that you need to move on from a team, even if the doctors have become an essential part of your treatment. It comes down to your quality of life and whether it's getting worse, better, or staying the same. Quality of life should always be improving. If your doctor can no longer figure out how to bring your care to the next level, it's time to let them go. Letting someone else advocate for you. There have been far too many moments where I've sat face to face with my doctor, having just received instructions from them, and all I can do is look at them and say, huh. Painkillers, exhaustion, brain fog. We won't always be able to put our best foot forward as a patient advocate when the patient we are trying to advocate for is ourselves. Before you find yourself in a bind, it's good to designate a person in your support tribe and ask for their help. This person can be a friend, a parent, a relative, a nurse aide. And if you're completely alone, there is technology and tools to help you stay afloat. Hold tight. We'll talk about that in a minute. What are the qualities you want to look for in a potential advocate? Well, that's kind of like saying you'd like to pre-select the nicest seat on the public bus you're taking tomorrow. You most likely will not get to choose who will take you to appointments and help you through them. You'll get whoever volunteers, and you'll say thank you with a smile on your face, even if you can't stand them. They don't need a medical degree, or need to know your entire medical history. They just need to be able to take notes, ask questions on your behalf, and work to not make you feel like you've put an unfortunate dent in their day's schedule. The last thing you need during the whirlwind of disorientation is a guilt trip for being a burden. At this point in my life, I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily scared to go to the doctor. I've been subjected to some pretty awful, yet very common, tests, and my fears of shots, scopes, and speculums are just about gone. There is still one thing that brings me uneasiness when going to see a new doctor. I fear that they will reject my case, citing that it's too complicated or that they won't have the time. During a very bad flare-up where I was floating between internists, I asked my husband to accompany me to a new doctor. My husband was a great source of comfort for me as we waited in the office for the doctor to finish up with another patient. The appointment, for the most part, went very well. The doctor understood my disease and was very empathetic and had great suggestions. However, at the very end of the meeting, he said he was sorry, but that he couldn't take me on as a patient. He just didn't have the time for such a complicated case. I was crushed. We had been waiting for this appointment for weeks, and in the meantime, I was spread thin trying to keep a lid on my out-of-control symptoms. In the car on the way home, my husband turned to me and said he was sorry it hadn't worked out. He also made me remember that the doctor said he would talk to the two other physicians in his office, and that one of them would surely be able to take me on while he was in and out of the country for a family emergency. It's all going to work out, my husband said, having no way of knowing this for sure. We'll meet with the other doctors, and if we need to, we'll keep meeting with other doctors. We'll find someone. It was exactly what I needed to hear at exactly the right time. It was something I would have told myself if I was alone in the car on my way home from this appointment. But having somebody else say it to me first made a world of difference in how I looked at the situation. I thanked him for telling me that and for taking me to the appointment. He brushed it off, but the truth is that if he weren't with me, this would have been a long and tearful ride home. Get over your humiliation of being carted around. Get over your concern that you're putting people out by asking them for their help. Get over yourself, because pride is a much easier pill to swallow than the reality of what happens when you don't put your healthcare as your priority. You are where you are, and you're going to have to make the best of it. Part of that is helping others feel as useful as possible in a situation where they also feel powerless. Remember, this is a key part of improving the understanding of your disease between you and your network of loved ones. Give them an opportunity to assist you. Here are some things you can do to help your advocate help you. Say, "Thank you, that was really kind of you to take time out of your schedule to help me get through my appointment." Ask them to help you remember questions or concerns you want to bring up but might forget about once you enter the exam room. Give them a piece of paper and a pen, and ask them to record some of the information from the doctor's appointment so you can read it later. Let them ask their questions too. They may not have a say in what treatment path you ultimately choose, but one more person in the trenches with you who has all the information is always an asset. Start thinking about selecting the appropriate people in your life to advocate for you when you cannot do so for yourself. There is only one real requirement for someone being your advocate. They should give a crap about you. Being a proactive patient. Don't you just want to burn every health magazine and pamphlet that has the phrase, "be a proactive patient" on it? It's like, "Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you're not supposed to walk on glass or eat gas station sushi." Of course I'm being proactive. I'm not actively being negligent of my health. As much as the phrase irks me, I've made it my mission to redefine it from its nasty stigmatization and into something that makes sense. I want to be a proactive patient. I want to do my personal best to make sure my body makes the most of its core defenses. Below is a list of ways in which you can be that kind of proactive patient. Fight to remain conscious when you are in the middle of doctor's appointments. Eat as close to a healthy diet as your condition will allow. Try to not give in to the urge to eat cheat foods that may cause a flare-up. Make sure to exercise regularly, even if that means doing laps around your hospital floor during an inpatient stay. Stay on top of your payment plans for medical bills. Be happy. When you feel well, see your friends, go to a party, have a night out, go on a date, see a new movie, or just lay outside in the grass and appreciate the sweet smell of not being in the emergency room. Being proactive is about being responsible for your own happiness, but it also means being responsible for your weaker moments, as we discussed in Chapter 8. Remember that preparation is your best friend when you are at your most vulnerable and your head is cloudy. When a serious issue needs to be resolved during a doctor or hospital visit, here are a few ways to keep you one step ahead of the brain fog. Have a list of your personal information, including your full name, date of birth, address, contact person, and address. Have a list of the medications you are currently on. Update this list as regimens change. Have a list of your allergies to medications. Get a medical identification bracelet. If you think you won't be able to remember the doctor's instructions, ask them if it would be okay to record your consult on your phone, or if they can speak slowly so you can write things down on a notepad. True advocacy, valuing your quality of life. It all comes down to these three words, quality of life. That's not just a phrase reserved for those on their deathbed, struggling to decide whether they should continue their treatment. It's a phrase for all patients in all situations, and I make sure to keep it lit up in the back of my mind for even my most trivial medical choices. Sometimes it's as simple as deciding that your quality of life would be improved if you didn't have to take the highway to get to your internist's inconvenient office. But many times, it comes down to decisions like, will the quality of my life change if this medication that improves my blood pressure also reduces my libido? Or will my overall quality of life be improved if I decide to have this surgery, even if it puts me out of commission in the short term? Many patients forget to make their quality of life a priority when they face a long road of chronic illness. They feel undeserving of a quality life because of the inconvenience and disappointment their disease might inflict on the lives of those they love. Sometimes their doctors don't offer choices, and they just decide to be treated by the book instead of asking for alternatives and seeking second opinions. There are many reasons doctors treat patients by the book. It's important to remember that you are the ultimate deciding factor in your treatment. You have a right to refuse treatment you feel will not be worth the benefit. You have a right to seek out another opinion by another physician. You can say, that isn't good enough. When facing choices that affect your quality of life, ask yourself these questions. Will it alter my appearance and disrupt my self-esteem? Will it reduce my ability to enjoy good food, entertainment, or company with my friends? Will it mean I'll have to stop working and rely on someone or something else for financial support? Will it give me anxiety each time I need to deal with it? Does it make me depressed every time I think about it? Will it cause more pain than I'm equipped to deal with? What are my alternatives? For me, it was important to test different medications to see if they could improve my condition. If I found out that they couldn't help me and that major lifestyle changes were the only way to a better quality of life, it made it easier for me to accept and commit to those lifestyle changes. Over the course of your illness, you'll experiment with medications, change doctors, switch hospitals, have surgeries, adjust your diet and exercise regimen, and experience different sleep patterns. You will make mistakes, regret decisions you've made, and wish you had done things better or smarter. But it's important not to view these blips in judgment as mistakes, but as opportunities to ask yourself questions like the following. What am I willing to give up to feel my best? What side effects am I willing to put up with? How much time and energy do I want to commit to treatments? How much suffering am I willing to endure? What doctors do I trust? What specialists are most knowledgeable about my disease? How can I communicate my symptoms most effectively? What preventative steps can I take to give myself the best chance of overcoming disease flare-ups? These questions allow you to take a step back in the middle of medical chaos and examine whether you're going in the right direction and remind yourself of what you want out of life. Are you comfortable with the way you're being cared for? Have you been pushed in a direction you weren't comfortable with? You always have the option of taking control and addressing the issues of living well with a life-limiting disease. You are deserving of living a life with dignity, honesty, and direction. So demand it. Chapter 10. Thriving with Chronic Illness. When I first started my blog, I decided to name it Let's Feel Better. I thought that was what I wanted. Isn't that what all patients want? To feel better? As I went through this great adventure of learning to live with a chronic disease, I did find my better days. They came when I had better doctors, better treatments, and better medication. Better was a concept that I ached for. I thought if my health got better, I would be happy again. My stress would decrease. I would be more independent. And I would have more opportunities in relationships and career. I did eventually get to a point where I was better, and I learned that better is not enough. You will face mountains and molehills through the trials of your disease, You'll pick your battles, stand your ground, and accept things you couldn't have imagined accepting when you were healthier. Your doctors will tell you at some point that your symptoms have improved.